unlike much of the discussion so far, this is rather more a paper about ways in which Wittgenstein has been sort of interpreted or taken up than being essentially focused on Wittgenstein's own writing, although it does shift from the first half, which has a focus on the later philosophy, to the Tractatus in the second half, and there I am getting a bit closer to the kind of primary text as well. Okay, I better get going and just see what happens. When Cora Diamond attempts to interpret Wittgenstein's remark, not empiricism and yet realism in philosophy, that is the hardest thing. She begins by making certain connections between Wittgenstein's aspiration towards philosophical realism and realism understood as a literary aspiration, one particularly closely associated with the genre of the novel. According to Diamond, in a realistic novel, we typically expect character to be built up out of observed detail rather than deduced from a label or typology. Like all Russian officials, he had a weakness for cars. We expect certain things not to happen, magic, myth, and fantasy, and we typically expect a certain kind of insistence on coherently grasped and displayed relations of cause and effect, an operative conception of how things actually work in our lives. Such expectations are, I think, consistent with a standard account of the origins of the novel as a genre, namely in a rejection of the prior genre of romance on the basis that its conventions appear to the novelist to misrepresent the nature of reality. They no longer facilitated a way of representing the world that had any chance of seeming accurately to capture its nature, as opposed to presenting a mere appearance or representation of it, hence a kind of falsification of it. In short, the novel's questioning of the generic conventions it inherits is in the name of a more faithful representation of the real. In truth, however, the novel was no less a genre than the romance. The individuals it portrayed didn't exist. The specific resources used to create the impression of their reality were no less conventional than those of any other literary genre. And the text as a whole couldn't but be anything other than a linguistic representation of the real rather than reality itself. And it wasn't long before the conventionality of the conventions of formal realism became apparent both to readers and to other novelists to inevitably subversive effect. By the 1760s, Lawrence Stern could write a text that simultaneously deploys the resources of formal realism to great effect in creating the impression of reality, but also makes their conventionality a thematic as well as a formal issue, to the point of parody. This is Tristram Shandy, of course. But precisely by pursuing the latently absurd implications of such conventions, by, for example, attempting to live up to the requirement that there be a one-to-one temporal correspondence between the novel and the reader's experience of it, Stern achieves an effect of realism. The reader thinks, if someone really did try to write in accordance with this convention, absurdity of just this kind would really result. And so Stern manages to recreate the impression of Tristram as a real individual, precisely by allowing him to enact the deconstruction of a preceding convention for the representation of reality, thus showing it to be no more than a convention, and simultaneously effacing the conventionality of the specific literary means by which this revelation is achieved. The history of the novel since Defoe, Richardson, and Stern might therefore be written entirely in terms of the way in which the novelists repeatedly subject their inheritance of realistic conventions to critical questioning in order to recreate the impression of reality in their readers, and in large part by encouraging those readers to see prior uses of convention to represent the real as merely conventional, in contrast to their own far more convincing ones. The realistic novel endlessly renews its claim to be an unprecedentedly faithful representation of individual human experience of the world in comparison with other literary genres, precisely by claiming to be more faithful to that task even than its novelistic predecessors. Only by ceaselessly testing, criticizing, and otherwise innovating with respect to the conventions through which it represents reality can the novelist create the impression that unlike her predecessor's merely conventional efforts, she's conveying reality to her readers as it really is. And since her best efforts could only result in the recreation of new conventions, they, and so the impression of reality that they make possible, will inevitably be vulnerable to the critical questioning of her own successors. And this parasitic process is not only open-ended, its reiterated criticisms of past conventionals will sooner or later test the faith of both novelist and reader in the very possibility of a representation of individual human experience that is at once both convention-dependent and authentic. One might think of the difference between modernism and postmodernism in this tradition as a matter of whether, in the face of this realization, the novelist can keep his faith in realism or finds himself forced to abjure it. In this paper, I want to suggest that Cora Diamond's way of inheriting Wittgenstein confronts us with a philosophical version of this modernist predicament, and instantiates one radical way in which one might keep faith with philosophical realism in the face of its inherent propensity to undercut its own aspiration. To see why, we might begin by viewing the signature concepts with which Wittgensteinian work is so often identified, concepts like language game, grammar, forms of life, as representational devices forged by Wittgenstein himself in the service of simply putting things before us as they really are, as ways of ensuring that we look and see what is in front of our eyes, despite our conviction that it must take a particular form, attention is over. Of describing the various ways language in fact works, despite our urge to misunderstand them, of delineating the actual use of words exactly as it is without either interfering with it or attempting to justify it. Those are all quotes from the philosophy chapter of Young. He took it that in many cases of philosophical confusion, our conflicted tendency to think that things must be a certain way, while being unable to deny that they appear for all the world to be otherwise, might be alleviated if we were to ask ourselves how we actually use words in this vicinity. And such self-interrogation is very often facilitated by conceiving of our life with words in terms of language games possessed of a grammatical structure and embodied in a specific form of life. But if, like any other representational conventions, this set of signature concepts is sufficiently substantial or robust to acquire a life of its own, then they might, on occasions, stand between us and an ability simply to acknowledge how things really are. Rather than helping to subvert our tendency towards the imposition of a philosophical must, they may actually subserve its further expression. And when a Wittgensteinian philosopher becomes so committed to the use of these signature concepts that he can't conceive of another way of perspicuously representing the phenomena of our life with language when responding to a philosophical problem, then he has, in effect, imposed a set of philosophical preconditions on the reality he putatively aspires simply to describe. He's donned a set of Wittgensteinian conceptual spectacles, one might say. And by employing those concepts as lenses through which he views everything, he actively subverts the realistic spirit in which their creator forged and at least attempted to deploy them. Of course, one might think that if Wittgenstein's signature concepts really are in the service of the realistic spirit of his philosophical enterprise, then there can be no tension between a commitment to that spirit and an equally resolute commitment to the deployment of those concepts. After all, if they were forged precisely in order to facilitate the redirection of our attention to the ways in which we actually use words in our lives, then they ought to possess the inherent flexibility and open-endedness needed to accommodate any pattern of word use that human beings have found and might conceivably find worth employing. So if one really takes on board the idea that the whole point or purpose of Wittgenstein's talk of language games, grammatical investigations, and forms of life is solely and simply to return us to our actual life with language, then one will recognize that conducting a grammatical investigation of a word by locating the language game that constitutes its original home in our form of life just means attending to how that word is actually used. If the formal way of describing the matter even threatens to suggest that the way in which that word is actually used must conform to certain prior conceptions, however minimal, of what legitimate word use is like, then its import, and so the true significance of the concepts employed to convey it, has simply been misunderstood. In my view, this isn't so much an objection to my way of stating the problem, but rather another way of articulating it. For where I invoked a willingness to sacrifice any Wittgensteinian signature concept, whose substance, however minimal, might in certain extreme or unusual contexts limit our capacity to apprehend the full range of our uses of words in all its rich variety. This putatively alternative interpretation prefers to talk of a willingness to reshape or recast our uses of those signature concepts in each new context of meaningful word use in such a way that they always subserve a perspicuous representation of its reality. But what, in the end, is the substantial difference between being willing to sacrifice any element of what we hitherto took to be essential to a signature concept in order that it might represent our life with language as it really is, and being willing to sacrifice the concept in order to represent our life with language as it really is? According to both interpretations, on those rare occasions in which the putatively independent substance of Wittgenstein's signature representational conventions even appears to threaten the realistic spirit of his enterprise, then faithfulness to that spirit requires a willingness to put those conventions in question, whether by radically reshaping them or by discarding them altogether. And to this extent, both interpretations converge on the adoption of a distinctively modernist relation to the challenge of inheriting Wittgenstein's realistic spirit in philosophy. Over many years, Cora Diamond has demonstrated an unerring eye for and a deep interest in a range of linguistic phenomena that not only clarify the proposal that inheriting Wittgenstein's work is primarily a matter of inheriting its realistic spirit, but also bring out the very real difficulty of doing so while continuing to employ, automatically as it were, his signature concepts. In this context, I'm just going to focus on two such phenomena, which in effect, on my reading, subject the projectability of those concepts to extreme stress testing, and thereby raise the question of whether a real commitment to the realistic spirit might actually require a willingness to sacrifice not only certain prejudicial interpretations of its familiar conceptual or discursive embodiment, but that embodiment itself. So, example number one. In her essay, Riddles and Anselm's Riddle, Diamond contests Norman Malcolm's famous reading of Anselm's ontological argument by exploiting Wittgenstein's comparison of a mathematical conjecture that lacks a proof to a riddle for which we haven't found a solution. The task of seeking a proof of the conjecture is given such orientation as it has, and so the conjecture has whatever meaning we may wish to say that it has for us prior to the proof's construction, on the basis of our familiarity with other mathematical concepts and procedures, an analogy with which the conjecture has been constructed. We play at using the phrase as an assumption, establish further conditions on that to which it may be held to apply, and then judge whether we're willing to accept that anything could meet all those conditions, whether the promise of a necessary connection articulated by the conditions that we establish might be fulfilled. Diamond suggests that Anselm's ontological argument is a working out of just such promissory connections. The riddle phrase, that from which nothing greater can be conceived, is itself constructed on the basis of a familiar model, great, greater, greatest, greatest conceivable. And Anselm draws upon existing linguistic connections between lacking something, being limited, being dependent, coming into existence, and having a beginning, to establish that if we were to call anything that in which nothing greater could be conceived, then it would be something that had no beginning. It's not that on the basis of our understanding of that in which nothing greater can be conceived, we know that it has no beginning, as if we were simply reminding ourselves of a language game that we know how to play. We are rather forging the outer shell of a necessary connection in a language that we don't yet know how to speak. Anselm's emphasis on the difference between existence in the understanding and existence in reality can then be seen as a potentially misleading way of distinguishing between ideas that we can and those that we cannot conceive of being the result of human inventive capacities. He wants to stress that our conception of what's possible might itself be shown up by reality, that reality might show us not only that something is the case that we imagined was not the case, but that something beyond what we'd ever taken to be possible, something beyond anything we could imagine as possible, was actual. If so, then that in which nothing greater could be conceived couldn't possibly be identified with anything that we can imagine to be a product of the human imagination. For we can then think of something greater than that, namely something that we couldn't conceivably, that couldn't conceivably have been conceived by us. Something in the light of which the products of our religious imagination appear as a queer collection of bloodless abstractions, sentimental projections, and so on. Something that reveals a logical space where none had seemed to exist. But if anything we were willing to count as that in which nothing greater could be conceived must be something that we can't imagine having merely imagined, it must also be such that if we were ever to encounter it, we couldn't imagine it never having existed. For if we could, then we could separate the idea of it from its actuality, could make sense of the possibility of making sense of it as a mere possibility to which nothing actual happened to correspond. And if so, then we could conceive of something greater than it, namely, something whose actuality is a condition for the possibility of conceiving it, something without which it is inconceivable that we could possess a language of any kind for it. Hence, anything we were willing to count as that from which nothing greater could be conceived would have to be something whose non-existence could not be conceived, whose conceivability is itself conceivable only on condition of its actuality. With ordinary riddles and mathematical proofs, it is only when we discover that there is a solution to the riddle, and how it counts as a solution to that riddle, that we fully understand the question that the riddle poses. Before this, the relevant phrases or propositions have only promissory meaning. But with that in which nothing greater can be conceived, Anselm has established that every statement we can make about it has, and can only have, a promissory meaning. The full transparency of that language to us is ruled out, because if it were to have a meaning we could fully grasp now, then we could conceive of something greater than whatever those words describe, namely, something whose nature exceeds the grasp of any concepts of which we can even conceive. And of course, that form of words, something whose nature exceeds the grasp of any concept of which we can even conceive, is itself no more fully transparent to us than any other form of words to which it is grammatically linked by the outer shell of a necessary connection. Or allusions to a language we can't even conceive of speaking before actually finding ourselves in a position to speak it. A language given to us by the being to whom it applies, and whose revelation of itself will effect the radical conversion of all our existing concepts of them. Accordingly, I claim, in the sense in which Wittgenstein normally claims that words have a grammar, these words don't. They are grammatically distinctive in that they have no grammar, but only what Diamond calls a grammar. On Diamond's view, that's what a close attention to the way we employ such words will reveal. But if we instead assume that any meaningful use of words must have a substantial standard Wittgensteinian grammar, we prevent ourselves from acknowledging the reality of this way of employing words. She's not denying that we do talk of God in the context of honest, transparent language games, whose grammar tells us what kind of thing is being spoken of. But she is claiming that whatever we are talking about in such games is not a possible solution to the riddle posed by the phrase that in which nothing greater could be conceived. For that is a form of words that stands in need of a determination of meaning, and one which must come not from us, but from whatever it turns out to apply to. Which is why Diamond talks of Anselm's riddle phrase as embodying a great riddle, since ordinary riddle phrases are given meaning by us, insofar as we can find a way of meaning them. Moreover, if whatever that in which nothing greater can be conceived turns out to apply to is capable of revealing everything we've hitherto imagined of God to be utterly misplaced, then part of what that in which nothing greater can be conceived might reveal is the utter inadequacy of our present religious language games and the forms of religious life in which they're embodied. Anyone willing to recognize that possibility could hardly think, as Malcolm does, that people who regard the God of the Old Testament as a genocidal maniac are conceptually or philosophically confused, simply because language games are played in which saying such things of God is ungrammatical. Does Diamond think that Malcolm's error here is simply one of operating with an unduly fixed or fixated notion of grammar? If so, one might have expected her to say that the phrase, that in which nothing greater can be conceived, does indeed have grammar, just not of the kind that Malcolm is inflexibly prepared to allow for. But instead, she persistently uses that signature concept in quotation marks whenever she applies it to the riddle phrase, as if she's equally unwilling simply to apply it in this context or flatly to deny it any application. Her quotation marks rather imply that the projection of this concept into this context ought to be experienced as far from straightforward. If one doesn't hesitate about whether or not to use it, if this aspect of our life with words doesn't force one to question the usefulness of this concept in this context, then one simply hasn't got the linguistic phenomenon at issue fully in focus. Okay, so that's the first example. Second one. In her paper, The Difficulty of Reality and the Difficulty of Philosophy, Diamond provides a range of examples of what she wants to call the difficulty of reality. And here I quote from that paper. The phenomena with which I'm concerned are experiences in which we take something in reality to be resistant to our thinking it, or possibly to be painful in its inexplicability, difficult in that way, or perhaps awesome and astonishing in its inexplicability. We take things so. And the things we take so are simply not to others such as to present that kind of difficulty, of being hard or impossible or agonizing to get one's mind around, unquote. Diamond's primary examples of this phenomenon are a Ted Hughes poem about the agonizing incomprehensibility of the destruction of young men's lives in the First World War, and Jeanne Kutzier's fictional protagonist, Elizabeth Costello, with her maddened, isolating perception of the moral barbarism of our treatment of non-human animals. She also cites a poet's talk of beauty, the architecture of a tree, the dawn chorus, as something that should not exist, for which there are no reasons for, and indeed reasons against, but which nevertheless undoubtedly exists. And a Holocaust memoir, in which a young woman's act of encouraging a terrified child seems to its author to be incomparable and inexplicable, although many people to whom she tells her tale wonder at her wonder, seeing nothing mysterious in the fact that some people are altruistic. Roy Holland's conception of the miraculous as the occurrence of something which is at one and the same time empirically certain and conceptually impossible, as with Christ's inaugurating miracle at the marriage feast at Cana, also fits the bill. For whereas many people, and not only philosophers, would rule out any such conception in advance, because it violates the very idea of a conceptual order, in the absence of which the possibility of genuine thought will vanish, others may be willing to take seriously the possibility that one's experience might force one to violate one's idea of what a well-ordered concept must be. So a difficulty of reality is an apparent resistance by reality to one's ordinary modes of life, which include one's ordinary modes of thinking and talking. To appreciate that kind of difficulty, and I quote, is to appreciate oneself being shouldered out of how one thinks, how one is apparently supposed to think, unquote. But Diamond can properly acknowledge such difficulties, she thinks, only by once again sacrificing one of the supposedly defining features of a distinctively Wittgensteinian approach to philosophy. For its business of returning words from their metaphysical to their everyday use is often glossed as a matter of rehousing words in the high mat of ordinary language games. But properly to register the essential nature of a difficulty of reality asks us to acknowledge the capacity of reality to shoulder us out from our familiar language, to resist the distinctively human capacity to word the world, and thereby to leave us as bewildered and disoriented as a bird that suddenly finds itself incapable of constructing a nest, or a beaver of building a dam. Would it be at all helpful in clarifying this highly distinctive aspect of our relation with our words to say that being shouldered out of our language games is just one more language game? Or to declare that words have a grammar when they fail us, just as they do when we effortlessly employ them to word the world? or to describe these uncanny encounters as just another element in the homely forms of human life. Surely difficulties of reality ought rather to resist the grammar of language game, grammar, and form of life, however flexibly they're projected, just as radically as they resist that of any other aspects of our thinking or talking. Okay, so a longer version of this paper has other examples, but I need to stop there if I'm going to get to the end of what's now miraculously reappeared. Taken one way, these are just two rather particular examples of Diamond's general commitment to Wittgenstein's realistic spirit rather than to his signature way of embodying that spirit. The notions of grammar, of rule-governed language games, and of criteria certainly do help us to put the ordinary or the everyday undogmatically before ourselves in many contexts. But in others, they risk impoverishing or narrowing down our sense of what the ordinary or the everyday might be, and thereby risk betraying our most fundamental inheritance from Wittgenstein. And whenever they do, we're obliged to dispense with them, to find other ways of embodying or maintaining the realistic spirit of our enterprise. Taken another way, however, the subject matter of these papers, the ones I've been citing, exhibit a certain kind of family resemblance, I think. Quite as if the nature of the philosophical error being diagnosed in each case, and the nature of the issues whose treatment exemplifies that error, are non-accidentally related. To begin with, both papers have a distinctively ethico-religious field of reference. The first is explicitly concerned with aspects of religious uses of words, and the second includes a religious inflection of the concept of the miraculous as a prominent illustration of the phenomenon with which it's concerned. Moreover, by referring to Anselm's riddle phrase as a great riddle, Diamond connects this aspect of religious language with Wittgenstein's invocation in the Tractatus of, quote, the riddle of life in space and time, unquote, and so to his early conception of ethics. And a similar focus on ethical matters is equally evident in the difficulty of reality paper. This distinctively ethico-religious field of reference also exhibits a certain thematic unity or interrelatedness. One might say that in both contexts, Diamond is attempting to demystify or detoxify the concept of nonsense. To suggest to those who are likely to be deeply attached to nonsense as a key Wittgensteinian term of criticism, that forms of speaking that either lack or transcend or refuse ordinary assignments of sense are not thereby emptied of human meaning. On the contrary, great riddle phrases and words failing us in the face of recalcitrant experience are both, one might say, techniques of language, part of the inconceivably rich human tapestry of our life with words, and ones whose usefulness for us precisely depends on the specific way in which each resists translation into transparently grammatical speech forms. One might also say that their variously inflected realizations of an idea of reality as capable of outstripping our means of making sense, of exceeding our best conception of how to conceive it. Great riddle phrases are the outer shells of a possible language game, whose proper inhabitation we can't even imagine, except on the basis of the authoritative actualization of its putative reference. And encounters with difficulties of reality disclose reality as essentially resistant to our ways of thinking and talking about it, as at once inexplicable or incomprehensible, and isolating, making us incomprehensible to others and even to ourselves. Putting field of reference and theme together, their link with the methodological error under examination seems to me hard to miss. For if we think of inheriting Wittgenstein as a matter of inheriting his signature concepts, we would be sorely tempted to view those concepts as constituting a field of philosophical discourse that is guaranteed to accommodate anything that reality might throw at us, or at least to license in advance the categorization of anything that does refuse accommodation as absurd or void. To do so would thereby amount to refusing in advance to acknowledge reality's capacity to exceed our conceptual grasp. A truly rigorous and thoroughgoing commitment to dispense with philosophical musts surely requires a willingness to dispense with any imposition of conditions on reality. And that would seem to include the condition that it make grammatical sense, that it be housed in transparent, grammatically governed language games. and so within the grasp of any given array of philosophically forged conceptual tools, such as that of a transparent, grammatically governed language gathering. If then, following Diamond's understanding of the matter, we rather think of inheriting Wittgenstein's philosophy as a matter of inheriting this realistic spirit, we would be committed to perspicuously representing the way reality presents itself in all its actual variety, including the various ways in which it refuses to submit itself to any given or preferred means of perspicuous representation. So understood, a connection emerges between Wittgenstein's later philosophical project and Diamond's way of interpreting his early conception of ethics, of aesthetics, and of philosophy. In her paper, Ethics, Imagination, and the Method of Wittgenstein's Tractatus. She there glosses a distinction which the Tractatus draws between the happy and the unhappy man. Quote, here from Diamond, "I characterized an attitude to the world in terms of acceptance of the independence of the world from one's will. The ethical spirit is tied to living in acceptance of the fact that what happens, happens. That one's willing this rather than that is merely another thing that happens. A sort of piety in action, in life, is possible that looks with clear eyes at the happenings of the world, at the happenings of the world being whatever they are." Unquote. Call this acceptance of the world's independence of one's will the orientation of the happy man. That of the unhappy man, Diamond articulates as a matter of his being dissatisfied at the world's refusal to meet the conditions he lays down, to submit to his control. Here she invokes Hawthorne's story, The Birthmark, and the Grimm's tale, The Fisherman and His Wife. In the former, Aylmer's discomfort at his new wife's birthmark leads him to a course of action which results in the destruction of her goodness, her beauty, and indeed her life altogether. In the latter, the wife of the fisherman, who finds the wish-granting flounder, begins by asking for a better home, and ends by expressing dissatisfaction at the sun's and the moon's rising independently of her will. The realistic spirit in philosophy looks remarkably like a further expression of the happy man's orientation to the world, of a willingness to acknowledge the world's refusal to conform to any condition one might lay down for it, hence to acknowledge reality's independence of one's will. And by the same token, our desire to impose such conditions, to inhabit the conviction that reality must be a certain way, or be wholly graspable within a certain conceptual scheme or discursive field or mode of representation, appears to amount to an inflection of the unhappy man's dissatisfaction with the world's independence of his will. And so understood, Diamond's way of inheriting Wittgenstein's later philosophical work as an inflection of modernist realism discloses an ethical dimension to it that is continuous with the ethico-religious spirit to which his early work similarly aspires, and which it likewise regards as inseparable from a certain aesthetic imperative, ethics and aesthetics, after all, being one. But are we willing to accept the full burden of that interpretation of the later Wittgenstein? What exactly is the aesthetico-ethico-religious spirit of the Tractatus? Well, according to Diamond, the Tractarian conception of nonsense is austere. There is no dividing nonsense sentences into two categories, those that are mere gibberish and those whose gibberish points to an ineffable truth. Those in the grip of philosophical nonsense have simply given no meaning to the sentences they proffer, but are under the illusion that those sentences are not only meaningful, but of deep significance. And the author of the Tractatus aspires, on this account, to liberate them from that illusion by self-consciously inhabiting it, with a view to leading them to recognize its emptiness from within. But if these philosophical sentences have no meaning, we can attempt to understand those who proffer them under the illusion that they do mean something, only by entering imaginatively into their taking nonsense for sense. And doing so seems to require that the diagnostician maintain herself within the same illusory logical space as her interlocutor, aspiring to specify what the interlocutor takes herself to be thinking or wanting or saying, whilst being fully aware that there is no such specification to be given. On Diamond's account, understanding the sentences of the would-be engager in ethics runs along parallel lines in the Tractatus. The ethical sentences themselves are nonsense, but the utterer of them is to be understood by imaginatively entering into the point of view from which such nonsense can be taken for sense. And such ethical sentences further resemble philosophical ones in reflecting the attractiveness of the idea of a point of view on the world as a whole, as if from without or sideways on, whatever may happen in it. However, the author of the Tractatus has very different designs upon the utterers of ethical nonsense sentences. I quote Diamond again. The attractiveness of philosophical sentences will disappear through the kind of self-understanding that the book aims to lead to in philosophers. The attractiveness of ethical sentences will not. But if we understand ourselves the utterers of ethical nonsense, we shall not come out with ethical sentences under the illusion that we're talking sense. Unquote. Suppose someone points out to us that talk of an attitude of satisfaction or dissatisfaction with the world as a whole is modelled on talk of attitudes to something in particular, some way that things are within the world which might satisfy or dissatisfy us, but that no sense is assigned by such familiar ways of talking to an attitude of dissatisfaction to the world as such, however things may be within it. That last phrase only appears to make sense. Then, according to Diamond's Wittgenstein, we may, for example, resolve to frame any future ethical sentences we're inclined to utter with words like, I am inclined to say. But we wouldn't lose our inclination to say them. Such framing would mark a certain gain in self-awareness, a liberation from unself-consciously taking nonsense for sense. But continuing to use the sentences so framed would also mark our continuing to feel that just these sentences, modelled on meaningful ones but unmoored from their patterns of use, express the sense that we want to make. Or rather, that our intentions in uttering them were essentially incompatible with making sense. Quote, every account of what he means which would make it out to be sense, he would reject on the ground of its significance. The nonsensicality of what is said belongs to the essence of the linguistic intention. What makes a sentence an ethical sentence is thus the intention with which it's uttered, an intention that, whether its user recognizes this or not, would be frustrated by the sentences making sense. To achieve clarity about this kind of attraction to a sentence means becoming self-conscious about that intention. But achieving such clarity is entirely consistent with resolutely continuing to use the sentence with that intention. Likewise, achieving clarity about what one is doing philosophically speaking, when one attempts to understand someone who is inclined to take nonsense for sense in this particular way, involves becoming aware that, since one is imaginatively inhabiting the point of view of the possessor of such intentions, one is drawing upon one's own capacity to inhabit linguistic intentions that are essentially incompatible with making sense. And hence, that successful attempts to embody the understanding one seeks will necessarily involve the use of nonsensical sentences. Accordingly, achieving that methodological self-consciousness is entirely consistent with resolutely continuing to use those sentences when attempting to impart philosophical clarity about ethical sentences. Any understanding we may achieve of the Tractatus's way of engaging with the would-be engager in ethics will therefore necessarily draw upon the same sources in us, the same array of impulses and intentions that we draw upon when we either proffer or respond to ethical sentences directly, if we do. Understanding the Tractatus's treatment of ethics means recognizing that its author requires exactly the kind of understanding that is required whenever one understands any would-be engager with ethics. That of imaginatively entering into the intentions of a resolute, and in this case self-aware, user of nonsense. To think that such an author's intentions might be accurately articulated in intelligible, sensible sentences of commentary would thus betray a failure to understand him. Or as Diamond puts it, quote, the book's ethical intention includes the intention of the book not to be interpreted, unquote. I'm inclined to say, if Diamond's interpretation of the Tractatus' treatment of ethics made sense, then we would have to reject it on the grounds of its significance alone. But recall, on a resolute reading of the Tractatus, for a sentence to be nonsense is simply for it to lack sense, for at least one constituent sign in that sentence to have no meaning assigned to it. Hence, to describe the intention of the would-be engager in ethics as necessarily frustrated by any intelligible sentence is simply to say that she refuses to accept any intelligible candidate articulation of her intention as an articulation of that intention. No such assignment of meaning to her utterance will satisfy her. Not because she wants to assign it an ineffable meaning, and not because she wants to assign different meanings to it simultaneously, but because she finds satisfaction precisely in refusing to find any available assignments of meaning satisfying. Hence, to understand her requires understanding why she might find intelligibility, to others and to herself, essentially unsatisfying. Diamond's earlier paper on Anselm presents a helpfully analogous context in which satisfaction resides in the refusal of sense. Anselm's riddle phrase is seen as embodying a great riddle precisely because it resists assimilation into any existing or imaginable transparent language games. That one so regards it comes out in one's refusal to accept that anything we can talk about in a language with a grammar, in the familiar Wittgensteinian sense of that term, could possibly be an answer to the question we're asking. If we could even conceive of explaining its grammar, it wouldn't be the phrase that those who use it want. And the point of that refusal is to mark a contrast between two conceptions of what it is to believe in God. One, according to which one can display what it is to have faith entirely in terms of the way a variety of religious language games are played. And another, according to which confining our attention to any such array would ensure that we entirely miss the point of talk about God. In the Tractatus context, of course, the special kind of meaning assignment to ethical utterances that is being resisted is that characteristic of fact-stating, empirical discourse in general, and of empirical psychological discourse in particular. Hence, the absolute or unconditional nature of the refusal indicates a sense of absolute discontinuity between the ethical and the empirical world. Quote from Diamond again, "That which I take myself to see in myself or another, if I think of that person as having a good or evil will, that thought of mine about a person has no room in the sphere of thoughts about the world of empirical facts. Put there, it's not about what I wanted it to be about." Unquote. Such a refusal isn't an objection to the very idea of intelligible, evaluative uses of language. Evaluating strawberries or sewage effluent can be understood perfectly well without requiring imaginative participation in taking nonsense for sense. So can the use of language to alter people's feelings and attitudes, or to express adherence to prescriptive principles, or to guide action. But for just that reason, such uses fail to capture what Wittgenstein means by ethics. That meaning is precisely given expression by his refusal of any such ways of assigning evaluative sense to his ethical sentences. And so it would be obliterated by any philosophical account, whether Wittgensteinian or not, that took it for granted that any meaningful ethical sentences must fit within such familiar, transparent modes of language use. The point of his refusal is thus to draw a sharp contrast between two kinds of evil, and hence two kinds of good. Quote from Diamond again, "Evil that is inconsequential, something close to home, something not very bad to which one might become accustomed, and evil as something terrible, black, and wholly alien that you cannot even get near," as the Brothers Grimm characterized the ethical vision of their fairy tales. "Take Rumpelstiltskin," finally he arrives. "The boastful miller and the greedy king are not at all nice, decent folk," Diamond points out, "but their badness is not connected by the tale with our capacity to respond to evil as unapproachable and terrible as Rumpelstiltskin's evil is," unquote. The evil of wanting not only to abduct another's child, but, as his gleeful, dancing fireside song connecting the child's arrival with cooking implies, to devour it. Little wonder the tale assigns a very different fate to the miller and the king than it does to Rumpelstiltskin, who tears himself in two with self-consuming rage. Now, sensible, well-meaning commentators have argued that Rumpelstiltskin is as much a helper as a villain in comparison with the girl's father and husband, even that he's the traumatized victim of loneliness. Hence, someone whose immorality is of an everyday, mediocre kind, and explicable in terms of familiar psychological syndromes. This is bringing Rumpelstiltskin's evil into the domain of the empirical world with vengeance, and it thereby evades the very contrast that the tale is designed to register. Refusing to draw such distinctions may appear as realism, expressive of down-to-earth, rational disdain for mystery and mysticism. But in truth, it simply obliterates their potential ethical significance, and thereby violates the realistic spirit. And the only Wittgenstein's removal of thought and talk about the good and evil will from empirical talk as such is essentially another way of marking that contrast, one of a number of possible techniques of language through which it might be indicated and maintained. This, one might say, is an aspect of the aesthetic achievement of the Tractatus. Call it the beauty of its willingness to cleave to words whose rightness consists in their emptying themselves of sense before our very eyes. And it's an achievement that is essentially continuous with the vision the text thereby advances of the internal relation between ethics and aesthetics, transcendentally considered, of course. But it's not just that the literary techniques of the Tractatus on the one hand and those of the fairy tales and short stories beloved of its author on the other are different ways of marking a crucial articulation of one and the same ethical vision. For Diamond, the purely literary versions of these marking off techniques work in highly specific ways to which analogies can also be found in Wittgenstein's philosophical writing, both early and late, and which sets center stage in the other papers that I cited earlier. The representational techniques of the fisherman and his wife, for example, have, according to Diamond, three critical or criterial features. But again, one, the kind of evil that Grimm needs. Two, its presence as something of which one may have a sense already in what is on the surface perfectly matter of fact. And three, its explicit connection, ultimately, with the wife's resentment that things in the world go as they do independently of her will. The second feature on this list is particularly interesting. The sense Diamond has that one may intuit the wife's cosmic dissatisfaction, even in her initial desire to have a cozy little house rather than a privy. Something that the tale actually marks explicitly by noting that the sea is already faintly discolored and mildly turbulent when the fisherman brings his wife's first wish to the Flanders' attention, as if the world-annihilating storm she eventually unleashes is already gathering its energies. It's internal to these thoughts about terrible evil that, quote, they seem to be justified by nothing that is, as it were, available on the surface of events. We have a sense of something dark and terrible within, as we might say, unquote. This notion of the inner as discontinuous thus embodies the discontinuity between ordinary badness and terrible evil, the latter's essential unrelatedness to everyday moral and psychological understanding. But it also connects it with a certain kind of resistance to our understanding. Its blackness not only a mark of its depth, but also of its utter unapproachability. Diamond's conception of Tractarian transcendental good and evil thus looks remarkably like an anticipatory example of what she will later come to call a difficulty of reality, a phenomenon which shoulders us out of our everyday ways of comprehending the world and what happens within it, presenting a traumatizing or agonizing resistance to our understanding. For an integral part of what is bewildering about such difficulties of reality is precisely that what we see as incomprehensible is seen by others as utterly everyday. Just as we can easily imagine readers of the Grimm tales who sense no cosmic evil in the initial responses of the fisherman's wife, and are correspondingly more likely to want to explain away or dismiss the Grimm's way of connecting those initial responses to transcendental good and evil. Difficulties of reality thereby serve to isolate individuals, disclosing others as opaque to them, and themselves as opaque to those others. Reality's resistance to our understanding reveals us as essentially resistant to one another's understanding. Just as those to whom ethics is a great riddle will seem incomprehensible to those who find nothing within them, no impulses, intentions, or convictions, with which such deliberately nonsensical formulations might resonate. And it's not as if those impulses, intentions, and convictions are entirely transparent to their possessors. On the contrary, Kadzia's Costello is periodically possessed by the conviction that she's going mad, becoming incomprehensible to herself as well as to others, incapable of understanding why these issues drive her to the brink of insanity. Likewise, those who recognize unapproachably terrible evil in Aylmer or the Fisherman's Wife can do so only because they're capable of imaginatively entering into the perspective of someone they conceive of as dissatisfied by the world's failure to submit to his will, which amounts to attempting to inhabit one kind of attachment to nonsense, even if the kind which survives its revelation as nonsense. And in so doing, as Diamond puts it, quote, I enter imaginatively into the seeing of it as sense. I, as it were, become the person who thinks he thinks it. I treat that person's nonsense in imagination as if I took it to be an intelligible sentence of a language I understand, something I find in myself the possibility of meaning. So to intuit terrible evil in The Fisherman's Wife or Rumpelstiltskin depends upon finding in myself the kinds of impulses and intentions that find expression in the nonsense that articulates that kind of evil, and that I imagine another saying in her heart, insofar as I do understand her. To identify incomprehensible evil in another thus depends upon a willingness to acknowledge a similarly incomprehensible possibility in myself. And as Diamond notes, this is central to Wittgenstein's later treatment of Fraser and the baleful rituals with which he was so preoccupied. What then of the transcendental goodwill? In order to intuit its presence in another, which presumably means being compelled to characterize that other in terms of a kind of piety in action, an ability to look with a clear eye at the world's vicissitudes and to acknowledge unconditionally its independence from his will, one necessarily resorts to nonsense phrases, and so registers a kind of resistance to the understanding in such goodness. But that resistance to sense surely goes further. It also involves a perception of the miraculousness of such goodness, the sheer incomprehensibility of its realization in the world, the utter inexplicability of such radical self-abnegation in terms of our best naturalistic patterns of moral and psychological explanation. And if one can enter imaginatively into the perspective of such a goodwill in another, that will be because one is able to acknowledge similar impulses and intentions in oneself, because one is willing to relate to oneself as inexplicably but undeniably capable of goodness beyond virtue, as well as evil beyond vice. Okay, just a very quick conclusion. But is it really credible to regard the realist spirit with which Wittgenstein works in The Investigations as essentially a further expression of such a transcendental conception of ethical value, as one way in which the orientation of the happy man towards the world as such might find expression, just as that of the unhappy man might find expression in resisting it? The suggestion might seem marginally less outrageous if we imagine reaching it in two steps. The first is to recall that part of what the realistic spirit requires is a willingness to acknowledge such phenomena as great riddles and difficulties of reality, and so a willingness to suffer a kind of philosophical wound, to be shouldered out of our most familiar ways of making philosophical sense of our rich and varied ways of thinking and speaking. For doing so involves drawing on a capacity imaginatively to enter into these ways in which we might intelligibly refuse assignments of meaning or sense to our words, which means finding within ourselves the possibility of, as it were, becoming the person who finds these kinds of satisfaction in nonsense. But to find it possible to mean such refusals just is to discover that we are the kind of person who can find such satisfaction in nonsense. So realizing the realistic spirit in philosophy in these domains is only possible for those who can find in themselves the capacity to make sense of such phenomena as the transcendental conception of ethics that pervades the Tractatus. And of course, even this initial local connection between method and vision is contestable. For anyone capable of making sense of such linguistic techniques will for that reason be incapable of seeing Diamond's willingness to look with a clear eye, even on the kinds of phenomena that manifest it, as anything other than an incomprehensible attraction to mysticism and mystery mongering. The very phrase, a aspiring to an absolutely unconditional refusal to impose conditions on reality is, after all, itself nonsense. Being constructed on the model of refusals that are context-specific, hence conditioned and relative. So if we can't make any sense of these difficult realities of our lives with words, then the philosophical practice of acknowledging them with a clear eye will inherit exactly the same riddling resistance to intelligibility that the phenomena themselves exemplify. Choosing to acknowledge rather than to deny such phenomena in philosophy is thus as capable of isolating us from one another, rendering us mutually incomprehensible, as are the phenomena themselves. Suppose, however, that we do take that first already isolating step. The idea of a more general connection between Wittgenstein's later method, whatever its subject matter, the quiet, apparently trivial weighing of linguistic facts, and such cosmic or transcendental ethical visions, might still seem absurdly overreaching. But consider, it may be that it's precisely when one's commitment to a methodological orientation is under most pressure, when its realization requires of us the most extreme and demanding forms of self-denial, that its underlying general significance is most likely to declare itself. Just as the extremity of the fisherman's wife's concluding demand makes manifest the spirit of her initial, apparently everyday wish. So understood, the point of asserting a general connection between method and vision need not be to imply that the philosophical imposition of conceptual preconditions on our life with words is always and everywhere a manifestation of evil as black as that of Rumpelstiltskin's heart. It may rather amount to sensing in any such stance the faintest turbulent discolorations of a gathering storm, and to intuiting a trace of something miraculously graceful in even the most modest and local resistance to such impositions. But of course, it's internal to something's harbouring a difficulty of reality that where one person sees a matter of fathomless significance, another sees only banality. Thank you.